Hello again, you're listening to Stephen Davidson's Looking Back on Our City Radio. Today we are joined by hugging world champion and comedy legend Mr. Patrick Monaghan. How's the Fringe going for you so far, Pat?
Well, thank you very much, Barry. It is good. Every year I try and top the amount of hugs that I give out. I mean, some people do call it harassment, but I do call it bringing joy to the Edinburgh Festival, because I think that's what a lot of drunk people need late on, you know, 2 a.m. after Late in Life is a good hug from me. It's going well. It's going good.
How many festivals have you done now? You're a veteran, wow. Pat, aren't you?
I have. When the Edinburgh Festival started back in 1946, I remember doing a small venue on the Cowgate, and I've just done it every year since then, really.
And what's your show called? Where's it on? It's crucial. Let's get the plug in straight away.
My show is called Adventures in Monaghan. Adventures in Monaghan Land at 8 o'clock. See, I don't even know the show title. I just turn up and do the show. 8 o'clock every night at the Guilty Balloon.
I've seen you do stand up many times, Pat. Mm-hmm. Been on the bill with you.
Yeah,
it's been a privilege. You are a fantastic improviser. But what sort of portion of your show do you arrive in Edinburgh with? You know, mm-hmm. Do you have maybe a scripted 20 or half an hour, and then think I'm going to bounce off the audience the rest of it?
Yeah,
is there a plan as strict as that?
Oh God, yeah. I would write probably for my hour show. I'd write about 2 hours of material, and then I edit it down. When I preview, I'm writing from September, October, November, all the new stuff, getting ready for the next show, for the next tour. And then I would say by May, June and July, when I'm previewing it, I cut it down from 2 hours down to about 1 hour and 15 minutes. Because I want about an hour and a half, 2 hours of new material, because I'm going to tour it straight after Edinburgh.
Yeah.
So I want to have, you know, you want to have an hour and a half of material, 2 hours of new stuff. But then when I come to Edinburgh, I do have about an hour and five, an hour and 10 minutes that I want to use. But in Edinburgh, of course, you're going to do 55 minutes. So then I literally edit again, and I end up dropping about a third of it, because then I end up bantering for the first 10, 15 minutes. Well, I say it's only 5 minutes, but I think it ends up being about 15 minutes of banter at the top, and then, you know, you'll find the guy, oh, that's a nice jumper, where'd you get your jumper from? Oh, hello. And then you just, you know, that's not in your show, but then you stick it in, and then you're there for, like, you know. But then I think that makes it special. Every night it's different.
And are you still loving the Fringe? I mean, has the Edinburgh experience changed for you over the years?
No, I would say, I mean, I was going to say, I remember what it was like when you first come in. It's exciting. You know, there they are, the Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, and we're just all there performing. It's, if anything, it has grown. I mean, when I first came, I was like, wow, there's a lot of places here for shows. And then now it's literally, there's more venues than there is buildings in Edinburgh. You know, they've literally just brought temporary buildings in just to cope with the demand. So, yeah, I think that does add to part of the buzz. You know, I think the locals are probably thinking, you know, it's only going to be so long before it'll explode, and they'll be like, right, we can't handle this anymore. But no, I love it. As long as, you know, people want to come and see comedy, I'll still keep coming. I think it's great.
Excellent. Part of this show, it's about the distant past. But before we do that, before we travel back in time together, can you give me a 1 minute snapshot of the first ever gig that Patrick Monaghan did?
First ever gig that I did, it was in a little bar called the Purple Turtle, and the bar's not there anymore. I think they've turned it into flats or something. And I remember walking in, and I didn't really know what stand-up comedy was. I just thought comedy was, you know, I'd grown up watching people like Dave Allen. I thought it was just about someone sitting on stage on a stool and talking. I didn't realise you had to have, like, you know, structure. You'd pause, punchlines, you'd have the rules of, like, comedy, like some people talk about that stuff. And it was literally just a pallet on a stage. The pallet was the stage on the floor, and it was so badly positioned. The gig was so badly run. It was, like, literally a pallet by the door. So when people would walk in, it was free to get in. I mean, people wouldn't pay to come in. It was just full of people having a breakdown on stage. They weren't really comics. It was, like, up and coming, or people trying to be comics. People would walk in and they'd swing the door open. It would smack the stage, and the poor person on stage would be like so nervous trying to hold this mic, trying to do their first 5 minutes. And it was just horrific, you know, people walking in and out. And I remember going in, and there was probably about 20, maybe 22 people, 25 people in the room. And I didn't realise 18 of them were acts. So there was, like, you know, about 9 in the first half, 9 in the second half in the compere. So it was me sat on a table with a couple who were, like, I think it was Spanish or Portuguese, couldn't really speak English, and they'd just gone in for a drink, and they were there. And I remember watching, and there was one guy who was actually all right. He was quite good. And the rest of them had potential, but it was like everything, you know. Some of them would go on, they'd start, lose the confidence, or they'd go on, and one guy was ranting about his wife leaving him or something, which was quite funny at first. And then you realise about 3 minutes in, you thought, no, actually, this guy, his wife has left him, and, and maybe he should have done this somewhere else. Yeah. Like, you know, maybe he should have just told a close friend or something before, you know. And it was, so a lot of people did come and just, you know, it was funny. It was like people letting off steam. And then I thought, well, do you know what? I mean, look, like anything, I think, you know, be a laugh. You've got nothing to lose. So I said to the comp, I said, look, can I have a go at this? You know, and he said, yeah, okay, I'll put your name down. Have you done any of this before? And I just, you have to pretend, oh, yeah, yeah, I've done this all the time, you know, because I was from up north and this was down south. So I was like, yeah, yeah, of course. And they stuck me on and I just went on and just talked. And he said, look, do 5 minutes. If you can't do five, then don't panic. You can come off at 4 minutes or 3 minutes and we'll flash you or whatever if there's any problem. And anyway, like 7 minutes later, he's flashing me and I'm thinking, oh, my God, I've done seven. So I just thought, oh, yeah, you know, this is for me. I love talking. I think this is the job for me.
And so now, we're going to play a record now, and then we're going to return. When we return, we're going to be looking back at the magical and often strange life that took Patrick Monaghan on that massive journey that led to that first gig. Mm. This is Sugar with All the Waves. Our City Radio, and with us today on Looking Back is the magnificent Mr. Patrick Monaghan. And Pat, with your permission, we are going to investigate the ingredients that have been added to the blender of your life to make Monaghan soup. Are you ready to join me to ride the horse of history back into your past?
Let's do it. I'm ready. I'm holding the saddle.
Let's go right back to the start. You're born Fitzpatrick Simpson Montgomery Monaghan, fifth son of Ruby and Ziggy Monaghan, Your parents were both professional surfers at the time, Pat. Your earliest memories must involve a lot of waves.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that's probably where some of my natural ability to hug was, because I was always trying to cling on to stuff in the water, and they'd always be like surfing off, and sometimes you'd just try and grab hold of a turtle, or sometimes it'd be an old mattress that was thrown in. But I think, yeah, that's what's given me my ability in life to hug people.
That's a lovely and fantastic start. And very early in your life, though, I mean, that is a lovely thing. But very early in your life, your mum and dad, in a gesture of what seems to me to be extreme tough love, Ruby and Ziggy, they leave you in the care of a family of otters for 3 months.
Yes.
I mean, that must have come as a terrible shock to a young baby.
Yeah, especially because I remember at the time, one of my favourite dishes was otter and lamb mincemeat pie. So half the time it was whether I, you know, take them in as a family or whether I eat them. And with otters, I don't know if you know this, but otters actually sleep holding hands at night, and it's so they don't drift away. And I think that was one of the hard things for me, was sometimes waking up in the middle of the night and nibbling on my dad's otter's hand, you know, just thinking, oh, should I eat a bit more of him if I can't wait for breakfast? But yeah, they were lovely, fantastic.
Yeah, and you see that as a happy time.
Yeah, I mean, I still keep them close to my heart. I mean, I've made slippers out of some of them.
So on your return home, Pat, your mum and dad, your real mum and dad, not your adopted otter mum and dad, your mum and dad decide that you are to become a child model, but you're rejected by 22 different agencies for being too handsome. I mean, how did that feel?
Well, I mean, it's one of them things with show business, isn't it? I mean, it's constant being accepted. And I think that's the hardest thing about show business. People talk about rejection in a lot of jobs, but with show business, it's so easy. Anyone with a face or who can speak can actually get far in modelling, comedy, or professional skydiving. That's one of the things you get used to, really. You know, the fact that, and I think that's probably what's made me develop better as a comedian, is the fact that sometimes I have to go on stage wearing a bag on my head or just pieces of otter to cover my face.
Just because of the excess handsomeness that you've been born with.
I wouldn't say handsomeness. Gruffness. Women love a bit of gruff.
So the first real achievement milestone, to go back, if you don't mind me saying, you're only there for 3 years when the first real achievement milestone in the world of Monaghan occurs.
Yeah.
You defeat a boy by the name of Linford Christie in the school sports race.
Yeah.
And Christie refuses to ever race you again. I mean, how did that feel when you saw the Olympic success that he had?
Well, you know, I mean, back in the day, I mean, to be fair, I mean, Linford was always a better runner than me, but I had the advantage because I had 12 otter's feet that I'd stolen from my last family after I'd eaten them, and I used their extra feet to help run faster. And I think that's the advantage that I had. And obviously, when you compete in the Olympics, they're a bit more stricter. They do tests, don't they? They check to see how many feet you've got, what otter parts you're using, and whether you're on drugs.
Were they inside your shoes, or were they outside the shoes?
No, I'd put them alongside the shoes, so they're like treadmills, like little caterpillars.
Oh, right, yep.
So to be fair, it was easy to spot, because at the starting lineup, I would take up about 6 spaces. So I think in the Olympics, they'd noticed that I was cheating. Whereas at school sports day, people didn't mind that you had 6 lanes. They just thought you were a bit obese, and they didn't want to make anything about it.
So you start primary school as your parents retire from surfing and open their new business, selling leg warmers and trinkets.
Yep.
Did they ever involve you at all in the running of the company?
Yeah, I mean, I remember a lot of the times I would go through bins looking for rubbish I'd call it rubbish, but they'd call it accessories and fridge magnets. You know, stuff that you'd buy overpriced in many shops, even particularly places like Edinburgh or any coastal towns. You know, them things that people think, do you know what, in a normal, everyday way of life, I wouldn't buy any of this stuff. I'd probably put it straight into a recycling skip. Mm. But for some reason, when you're on holiday, it's a great idea to buy that stuff. And I think my parents saw a niche in the market that, you know, people will buy rubbish. I mean, look at the websites now, like eBay, Recycle Free, Craigslist, all them sort of things. I mean, yeah, it's just people buying rubbish. And I think that's the great thing. If you can put that into a shop, great business. I mean, they've got a good business brain. Unfortunately, they didn't pay the tax.
And that kind of, your parents going to jail for, it was only 3 days though, wasn't it? They were in jail.
3 days. I mean, only because it was a bank holiday weekend. And a lot of the prison services, you know, they like the bank holidays, so they did let them out early. I mean, if it was just a normal week, they would have probably spent about 5 days.
Yeah, but those 3 days, you used those 3 days very wisely. you practice football intensely, and so that by the time that you're eight, it's almost a stick on that you're going to become a professional footballer.
Yeah.
But then that comes to a sudden halt when bingo enters your life. I mean, can you tell us a bit about that?
I think the fact was, I mean, I like football, but the thing that held me back about football was that the ball was too big. And it was one of them things where, okay, it's all right to kick, but sometimes you just like to grab it with one hand and then do stuff with your other hand. And I think that's where bingo was great for me, because the balls were just so easy that you could probably grab about two or three balls in one hand, and with the other hand you could hold like a dauber pen or a microphone. And that was the advantage for me that made me more interested in bingo. Whereas with football, you can't really grab the ball with one hand unless you've got a big hand. And not many people have a big hand. I mean, some people have small hands. I mean, like the late, great Jeremy Beadle. But, you know, he would have probably... I mean, to be fair, he'd have probably struggled with bingo as well, because his hands would have probably been too small for bingo balls. But, yeah, that's where it took off my excitement, was just the little balls that you could grab. And the numbers, I loved numbers. And I think that's the excitement. And also old ladies. I mean, that's the thing with football. You do get old ladies, but they're very aggressive. And I think with bingo, I like them older ladies that, you know, that there's not much left for them to do. And I think bingo brings us together on their final journey towards, you know, towards that next place. Whereas with football, these old ladies would turn up and some of them would bring weapons, knives. It was a bit aggressive. So I had to get out of that business.
And the next question, Pat, is... it's something I really thought about whether to ask you this or not, but it's maybe something you want to keep secret. But
yeah.
Chapter 4 of your autobiography, it covers the years between 8 and 10 or so, but it has no words, just a hand-drawn picture of a shark. I mean, can you explain the meaning of that? Do you want to explain the meaning of that?
It was one of them nights when we were with my otter family and we were just sort of chilling out and sleeping just in the, one of the lakes near here, Loch Lomond. And everything was nice and calm, and then suddenly a fin appeared from nowhere. One of the sharks had somehow got into the lock from the Pacific, and it's a very common occurrence. A lot of sharks, people think we don't get a lot of sharks in Britain, but you do. A lot of them will swim along the Gulf Stream, and they'll come through the hot waters, and then the last bit they'll probably do like on the Virgin train or ScotRail. They get a train through to the locks, and it was quite horrific. They actually did come and they just finished off. They ate my family, and luckily I had enough otter's feet left that I managed to get out of the Loch Lomond before the shark attacked me. But I always remember that shark. I drew a picture of it, and it's in my autobiography.
And I suppose just telling that story like you've just done there would be too upsetting to write down.
Oh, so God, yeah. It's much easier to tell.
We'll go on to happier times, Pat. The modelling career, it never got off the ground.
Yep.
But you have a huge amount of film success in these years, in your early teenage years, acting in the Basil the Dog trilogy. Remember those happy days?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't know this, but Basil wasn't actually a real dog. I mean, Basil was actually, he was actually just a fella that used to work in finance, but he'd obviously worked through one of the first economic downturns and recessions that we had, that he went absolutely mental. The guy had a breakdown, and a lot of big companies like KPMG and all these guys, they wanted to see him do well, and instead of, like, you know, just trying to put him back into rehab, they just put him into this TV show with us, and he was amazing. But the only thing that let me down was he never used to wear an outfit. He used to just turn up in a suit and a tie, so it was a bit awkward referring to him as some sort of dog when he was really just an ex-city trader.
And you, this is a real puzzling time, because it's maybe even linked to, you do one more film, only one film, but with the guy, the city trader who played Basil the Dog.
Yeah.
Again, a huge success, I think, because of you're the two big names from Basil the Dog.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, this is really puzzling to me, Pat, but you never make another film.
Yeah.
Because you say to the Hollywood people that you would only act again in cowboy films.
Yeah.
Why did you take that stance?
Well, I was always a big fan in the early days, you know, of cowboys film. I used to love people like Morgan Freeman and, you know, people like that. And he was, I mean, obviously he never did a lot of cowboy films, but if he could, he would. And I think you get inspired by people like that. And I think that was the problem with Basil, was that even though he made a great dog, he was actually allergic to horses. And once we tried to do a pilot for a cowboy film, and it was just a nightmare. I mean, we lost half the budget just trying to get Basil back into the paddock, because he kept chasing the horses. And one time we found him just weeing around the stables. So I think that was the end of the career, really. I don't think I could see it. You know, I couldn't really stomach it anymore, trying to do a film while Basil was defecating on just, you know, some of the stable hands and some of the cowboy equipment that we had in the fields. So I think that was, I think it comes at a time in your life when you just have to sum up everything. You think, well, do you want to go and pursue a new career in stand-up comedy, or do you want to stay and try and rekindle this career with an old ex-city trader who's made his acting career as a dog, but also wants to move into cowboy films and spends most of his time chasing horses and defecating on people wearing cowboy hats and carrying saddles. Yeah, I think it was easy.
It's a good point. It's an easy decision, isn't it?
It is easy.
And yet showbiz presents itself once again in a different format. You enter your mid-teens with a fair amount of money. You know, you've got all the Basil the Dog cash, you've got loads of fans. I mean, was having that kind of financial security, was that the reason why you turned down your four brothers when they asked you to join the band?
Yeah, I think there's only so much you can do with family, and the problem, I suppose, that I had with my family compared to a lot of people was that they were otters. And as much as people like shelling out £55 for a concert ticket, I don't know if there's many people who want to spend, you know, £55 to see a bloke and four otters on stage banging out instruments. And otters are not, look, I mean, most otters can play the flute and that's about it. I mean, there's only so much music. I mean, look, Mumford and Sons, they've done well just playing the flute and the banjos and crisp box and I don't know what else. They play banjos, I think, and they also play empty ice cream tubs. But otters can't get away with that. They've not, you know, otters have only got six fingers and it's a bit difficult for them to, you know, you can't play an 8-chord string on a guitar.
Yeah, it's amazing, Pat, how everything for you, it comes back to the otter family. You mentioned them.
Yeah.
You very rarely mention Ruby and Ziggy. It always comes back to the otters. And that leads me nicely into what... This might, again, it might be too emotional for you, Pat. But, but it's, at that stage of your adulthood, you decide, you're sort of 17 or 18, you decide on a return visit to the otter family, and that goes badly wrong.
Yeah.
You stay with them for another 3 months, reconnecting and also teaching them sign language.
Yep.
And then the first thing the otters do with it is they sell your story to the tabloids. Did you feel let down?
Not really, because I thought it'd be great. That's starting to do a bit of comedy, wanting to get in to do some Edinburgh shows, and I thought the best way to get publicity is to get some otters to sell your life story to the papers. I mean,
so look, it was a plan, Pat.
Yeah, it was a great plan. I think the guys were fantastic. I mean, I didn't initially come up with the idea. Geraldine and Frankie Howard, the third in line of the Otter clan, they came up with the idea and said, well, look, what we'll do is we'll get you fixed up with some of these people in town, get a picture and that, and then we'll sell some of the stories. And I thought, yeah, what can go wrong? And then obviously a shark came and killed them.
Yeah, and the shark... This as well is difficult, and I can see how upsetting the shark eating the otters was for you. But those otters who went to the press, I mean, this must have jarred slightly. They said to the press that they'd never seen you before. It wasn't actually the same family that you stayed with when you were a baby.
Yeah, that's the problem with otters. I mean, when you've met one, you've met them all, really. They do all look the same on the outside, but if you do fleece them and if you eat the meat, they actually do taste differently. But that's the problem, isn't it? If you have killed them and eaten them, then you can tell the difference, but then it's difficult to have a conversation with them afterwards.
Yeah.
So dead.
So with dead otters aside, Pat, so out into the big bad world we go, you know? You're kind of leaving the otters behind you. But first of all, I'd like to play what you've described as the greatest record of all time. It is, of course, Robots by the Goosebumps. Mm. What makes that record so special for you?
Well, it was one of the first times I'd heard sound in that wasn't from an animal or from someone that was having a breakdown as a city trader. And I think this was this was one of them tracks I heard. I remember just walking across the meadows and, you know, in the orchards and through the wilderness. And I remember the first time I heard music, and it was from this guy who had he had a bike. And there was no music player on it. It was just... The more he pedalled, the more the music came out, and it was this track. I remember asking him. I said, "Oh, what is that track called?" And he said, "I can't." Yeah, Robots. He said, "I can't tell you what it is, but you'll find out in years to come." And I said, "Oh, thanks very much." And there it is. I found out today.
This is the Goosebumps on our city radio. We'll be right back.
sense at all.
This is Looking Back on Our City Radio. I'm Stephen Davidson and I'm returning to the incredible story of Pat Monahan. So basically, we've got to the point where you've become a man,
mm-hmm.
not from being a woman, but just developing into a full-grown man.
Yeah.
But a man who decides to spend the next 10 years of his life doing odd jobs.
Yeah.
And not like a handyman, more like a sort of employment adventurer. Do you remember the first of those jobs?
Yeah, I remember. I mean, it was quite interesting because I remember being given that option as well, that, you know, when you were saying growing up as a man and they said, do you want to be a woman? And I said, yeah, I'd love to be a woman. And then they told me about all the jobs that were available to women, and there was quite a lot. And I thought, yeah, this isn't for me. And they said, do you want to be a man? And I said, well, what are the options? And they said, if you're a man, you basically, you get a hammer and you can smash stuff up. And I said, okay, what's the other job? And they said, or as a man, you can get a brush and you can sweep stuff up. So I was like, oh, this is great. I thought, well, I could either smash stuff up or sweep stuff up. And I think that's one of the first jobs I got as a man was being a sweeper. And it was amazing because the amount of stuff that you sweep up was unbelievable. I mean, just some of the stuff that you find that people smash up is unbelievable. I mean, a lot of the things I used to sweep up was the main things was obviously people loved to smash up cars. And I used to love sweeping them up. Cars, empty cans, people like to smash them up, and dreams, people used to smash up dreams. I used to love sweeping up dreams, broken dreams. It was fantastic. In fact, I could have wrote songs about them, but I didn't. I just put them in the recycling units next marked dreams.
And there's a lovely quote from a guy, Jim. Do you remember Jim Thompson?
Yeah,
you worked
Jim,
with?
Yeah, he was a great guy.
Jim's quote, he said, Patrick was a small guy but he never missed anything.
Yeah, that's right.
By that he means that as you were sweeping, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the thing about Jim was he was very interesting. Not many people did what Jim did. He was a sweeper, but he used a hammer. And most people would use a hammer to smash stuff up, but Jim was always against the grain. He would always like to sweep stuff up with a hammer. And I think that's why he said, you know, I never missed anything, because it was a lot easier for me to actually sweep stuff up because I actually had a brush, whereas Jim really didn't sweep anything. He just pretended to, but he actually just created more of a mess. So I suppose it was always... I would take that as a double-handed compliment, as a fact that Jim was being nice and also that he didn't know how hammers worked.
And it was Jim Thompson as well. It was Jim's brother, Gordon Thompson, who introduced you to your next job, which in turn ended up with you going out with Kim Wilde and Anita Dobson at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, the next job was as a badger herder. And it was just amazing, really, because Kim Wilde at the time, people didn't realise this, that she used to own badger onesies, and it was half the inspiration to help her write songs. What she would do is, during the day, she would go in the studio and sing the songs, but at night time, to get the inspiration to write the songs, she would put her badger onesies on and go out in the wilderness. Same with Anita Dobson. But Anita obviously didn't have to wear the onesie because she had this beautiful bloomage hair, and she'd just brush it around her, and then she would literally just look like a badger. And they were lovely, and they'd go out, and then... I remember Brian May, he was a big guy for anti-badger culling, and he met Anita, and then obviously I met Kim Wilde, and the rest, as they say, is history. And, I mean, if you go on Wikipedia, you could probably read about the time that me, Kim Wilde, and Anita Dodger, Dodger and Dobson, Anita Dodger was Dobson's third cousin, who sometimes got involved as well, but we couldn't talk about her because she was never on the payroll.
And is it not the case that Anita Dodger has been scrubbed out of the family history because she made up the catchphrase that you still use to this day, Pat, Pat, how's about that?
Yeah, it's a great catchphrase.
That came from Anita Dodger, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Anita...
So you admit that now?
Yeah, exactly. I didn't, I mean, at the time I didn't, because she put it on T-shirts and she used to sell them all, mainly around... I mean, this was a great thing. She always had a great brain for ideas, you know, Pat, Pat. How do you think about that? You know, these catchphrases. She loved it. But the thing was, she made these T-shirts, and I thought, these are a great idea. But she'd only sell them in certain forests and woodlands. And, I mean, as you know, like most people know, the footfall in woodlands and forests isn't that great. I mean, sometimes, yeah, you might get two people rambling through. But other days, you'd get no one. Maybe you might get a couple of crows and... You might get a couple of wild hogs, but these are not your target audience for selling T-shirts. So eventually, after 17 years of her selling T-shirts, which she'd managed to sell one, I just thought, you know, I had to get rid of her, you know, and just forget about her history, really, because she's... I've known better friends.
Yeah. And I know exactly what you mean. I have a very similar story in my own life, which I won't go into. But we're almost up to date, Pat. Basically, I mean, we've done the twists and turns of your life. I mean, from the sweeping job, from the job with Kim and Anita, basically it's 14 years as a helicopter pilot.
Yeah.
And then we're right up to the point in your life when you become a stand-up comedian. So can you just, you missed this bit out.
Yeah.
You've not mentioned this at all. I'm surprised about that. But can you just tell the story of the witch and her role in your decision to try stand-up?
After I'd finished the Badgers and I'd left the Otter family and we'd done all the surfing, and then I thought, well, you know, like everything in life, most people normally sit down and they get a piece of paper and they write down what the pros and cons, and they think what they like doing, what they don't like doing. And a lot of people will speak to a mate or someone and they'll go through it, or maybe a careers advisor. But for me, it was a case of... I remember I used to like to wear a lot of black garments and carry around my sweeping broom. And I remember watching a film one night. It was Eastwich, and Bruce Willis was in there. I was a big fan of Bruce Willis. I used to love that show that he used to do about the moonlighting, and that woman that was in it, that was she had a different name to Bruce.
Yeah.
And I remember watching that, and I remember thinking...
Cyril,
that was it. Do you remember her? Cyril Shepherd, lovely lass. And I remember thinking to myself, I thought, what do I like to do with my life? And I remember standing on top of the roof and I was of the house, and I had my broom, and I thought, well, I don't want to sweep anymore. And I was just straddling it and a nice black garment, and I thought, I might be a witch. And then I was about to jump off the roof. Luckily, a witch had come by and she went, have you done this sort of stuff before? And I said, what? And she said, jumping off roofs on top of a broomstick. And I went, yeah, I've seen Aces of Witchwick and all that sort of stuff. And she went, I don't think that's the actual name of the film. And I said, yeah, but, you know, I've never actually been a witch either.
Yeah.
And she gave me career advice and she was just saying, look, doing stand-up is pretty much like being a witch, apart from the age difference. And so I said, yeah, well, thanks for the advice. I think I'll give it a go. And it was really just from that, really, just gentle, simple advice.
Yeah, it's a remarkable life, absolutely remarkable life. And I'd like to kind of finish, wrap up now, Pat. If you'd be so kind, I'd like to put you on the spot a little bit with our usual short and sharp section of the show, which is called Stand By or Catch a Ship. So basically, I give you statements that you've made over the years, and you either stand by them or you distance yourself from them, which is you catch a ship. Okay, so these are things that you've said.
Yeah.
First of all, Hoovers are beautiful.
Yep, stand by that. As a sweeper, I always believed in a good hoover.
Okay. Number two, if you hire a hypnotist, they can teach your dog to talk.
Nah, walk away from that. Never touch dogs.
Catch a ship is the phrase, Pat. It's crucial. Catch a ship.
Catch a ship.
Yeah, okay.
Catch a ship.
Okay. Number three, FIFA offered me £15 million to change handball in the rule books to monohandball.
I would love to say stand by, but I'm going to have to catch a fish because I would, or catch a ship, in fact. I like the fish as well, but I would have took 10 million, never mind 15 million. Yeah. Catch a ship.
Sorry, 3A this is actually. Perhaps a radical period in your life when you said this. They should set fire to people who watch documentaries.
I would stand by that because I always believe that everyone is a documentary and they should make their own documentaries. Obviously, get a professional to film it. Don't just film it on your phone. I'm sick of watching documentaries that have been filmed on people's phones. But I would stand by that. Probably wouldn't set fire to them with fire. Probably set fire to them with, like, water.
Yeah. Mm. And finally, on this particular section, I used to pickpocket people when I hugged them.
Yep.
Stand by?
Oh, God, I mean, yeah, of course. I mean, that's the only reason I hug people. Stand by it, yeah.
Well, that's a wee bit disappointing to me, that last one, Pat. But fair enough.
Catch the ship.
Patrick Monaghan, it has been an absolute pleasure being in your company.
Thank you, as always. Thank you.
And we finished by playing your funeral song.
Yeah.
Although you've previously stated that you have no intention of dying.
Yeah.
You've chosen a song, you've got lined up, Decent Shoes by the band Stolen Have.
Well, yeah.
Why that tune to go out on?
Well, they were always good friends of mine, and it was a shame that they all passed away at an early age. I mean, just it wasn't my fault, but there was only really room in the lift for one of us, so the rest of them had to go, and I gave them a gentle nudge, and they fell off that 17-storey building. And in homage to them, I've always listened to their music.
So it's a kind of, I'm coming to join you.
Yeah, exactly.
After I killed you.
I'm coming to join you guys. Thanks for taking one for the team.
It's phenomenal. Pat, thank you so much for looking back. We wish you the very best of luck going forward.
Thank you very much for having me. Always a pleasure.
This is Decent Shoes by Stolen Have on Our City Radio.
Is that a brush?
Hello, girl, I know. Maybe from a dream I had, maybe from a dream we had some time ago. And you appear to be so sad. Eyes are wrestling round the room. Guess that you'll be leaving soon. What time we had. Over love, over money, over faith, over fame, over fairness, over caring for the titles to your name. Give me truth, give me honest, give me far from you. Give me my jacket and my guitar and a decent pair of shoes. Give me truth. The house and This gang in town won't be the last. We have ourselves a perfect cast. Just lost the plot. Over love, over money, over faith, over fame, over fairness, over caring for the titles to your name. Give me truth, give me honest, give me far from you. Give me my jacket and my guitar and a decent pair of shoes. Over love, over money, over faith, over fame, over fairness, over caring for the titles to your name. Give me truth, give me honest, give me far from you. Give me my jacket and my guitar and a decent pair of shoes. Over love, over money, over faith, over fame, over fairness.